Okay, so we're in the seventh chapter of Romans, and there's a lot of stuff to work our way through. I'm trying to remember exactly where we stopped. You'll probably remind me, but I think it was someplace around verse 12 or something like that. Anyway, this argument in chapter 7 is, you know, first we talked about him turning the argument of the woman who dies upside down and working the reverse logic on that. And then we talked about verses 8 and 9 and 10, where he says that, according to the NASB, sin taking opportunity through understanding the law made it possible for wrongdoing to occur, because the presentation of the right way always included the opposite. And then he says, I remember we worked on this verse, I was once alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin became alive and I died. And of course, he's talking about, you know, he's not talking about the fact that he didn't know what wrong was before the Torah. What he's saying is that the idea of being guilty for a series of divine commands doesn't show up until Torah is active, until I understand that. I can still have, I can still feel the guilt of my social environment and society, but he's saying that there's something else that's involved here. And of course, when I realize that God also has requirements, then the condition that I'm in is far more serious. So then he says, and this commandment, which was to result in life, proved to result in death for me. And of course, he's not saying that the commandment made death possible. What he's saying is that the fact that the commandment existed at all pointed out, made clear what the opportunity for the opposite was. And so, even though it intended to direct me, I end up in a situation where, not always, of course, but where I see the possibility of an alternative and choose that. And this is going to take us to 14, which is a really interesting verse and has lots and lots of theological implications to it. And that through 20 is really a difficult section. So we'll work on those. Anyway, he said, obviously he says this was that which is good the cause of death for me? No, he says, rather it was sin. And of course, now Augustine comes along and says, well, you see, sin is like an alien force that's in Paul. And so Augustine's view is that, we have this compulsion to sin, which causes us to do something irrational. Remember, Augustine's a Platonist. So his view is that if we just did the rational thing, we would automatically do the right thing. But because we have this compulsion to do the irrational thing, we end up in this battle, which we often lose, as a result of what happens with this internal element, this sinful compulsion that's within us. And now we get to 14, okay? So, 14. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am flesh, sold into bondage to sin. And that's the NASB translation, so we're going to have to talk about that because there's some weird things going on there. But the point is that this verse, if there was ever a verse in Paul that makes you think that Paul was really a disguised Platonist, this would be the one, right? For we know that the law is spiritual, okay? But I am of flesh. And of course, what that looks like is a complete dichotomy between the spiritual world and the corrupt physical world of flesh, right? Which is a Platonic idea, right? The corruptible, the temporal, the existential is bad, and the eternal, the spiritual, is good. And of course, for Plato, that meant that your intention was to get out of this spiritual prison, out of this corporeal prison that you're in, and migrate to the spiritual. And of course, you do that through eros, because eros isn't just erotic. Eros is the attraction. It's love that attracts itself to an object. And the object, of course, is this spiritual existence where you're no longer subject to bodily temptations, and you remove yourself from the physical environment and become a part of the spiritual world. Okay? So if that's what Paul's saying, then Paul is, without any question, a Greek Platonist. Okay? And the church in its history used this, a verse like this, to really move in a Platonic direction. That's why Augustine, who was a Platonist, viewed this as Paul's declaration of an essential sinful nature in human beings. And the rest of this passage now, 14 to the end, is going to be developed along Augustine's line if you believed in the Reformed doctrine of a sinful nature, because it looks like that's what Paul is saying, okay? But now let's go back and just take a look at some of the words so that we know exactly what's happening here. And then we'll take a look at how Uriel ben Mordecai translates this from the P46 and see where the changes are. Okay? So, for we know that the law is spiritual. Okay, so we know that the law is spiritual is essentially Paul saying we know that the law is of divine origin. He's not saying that there's something about the law that's so out of this earth that it exists in this perfect domain called the spiritual heavens where everything is perfect. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is that the Torah has divine origin. Okay? Now, why is that important? Because the Torah is about living in the physical world. The Torah is about my relationships with the other people, my relationships with the earth, my relationships with society. It's all about the here and now. So if Paul meant that the law is spiritual and somehow only appropriate to the heavenly realm, then we would have to conclude that no one on earth can keep it because it doesn't fit here. Here we're stuck in the corporeal, you know, the bodily world. And if the law is truly spiritual in a Platonic sense, then it can't apply here, right? So obviously Paul doesn't believe that, because Paul constantly talks about the necessity of the commandments. We've seen that since the very beginning of this letter. So what Paul's really saying is that the law comes from a divine origin. It's spiritual in the sense that it doesn't come from the rational ethics of a society. Okay? That would be important for the converted pagan audience that he's writing to in the assembly, because they grew up in a world where either rules and rituals came from worshiping one of the pagan gods on pain of punishment, or they grew up in a civil society where the regulations were developed by the rational thinking of men, right? And if you're a Platonist, and Paul could be easily addressing people who were influenced by that because Hellenism was all around, then you would think that the true ethics they're of divine origin in a different sense. Remember Christina Hayes' book, What's So Divine About the Divine Law? What does she say? That if you're a true Hellenist, the law that is divine is the law that reflects the order of the cosmos. So you would say the law is spiritual, meaning that it cannot be written. It is completely eternal. It has no transitory elements. It's not susceptible to interpretation. It isn't a part of the situation of human beings. And last but not least, it can't be human, right? That's a spiritual law, a law that governs the way that the universe operates. And for the Greeks, of course, that was the equivalent of scientific principles and scientific laws today. And so if Paul says, we know that law is spiritual, from the convert's perspective, that resonates because they have already believed that there is a higher law than just the laws of their ethnic group and their society, right? And Hellenism would have endorsed that. But, of course, that leads us to the question that Christina Hayes raised, which was, if that's the case, then you have to reject Judaism's Mosaic code because it's just the opposite. It's written, it's temporal, it's got plenty of human elements to it, it's situational, all those things that would exclude it as a universal law in a Hellenistic paradigm, okay? So we have to decide, how's Paul going to approach this? I believe that Paul, as an Orthodox rabbi, is approaching it from the same perspective of the Jewish origin for the last several hundred years before Paul, which is that the emphasis is on the origin of the law, not on the function, if I can put it like that. So it's possible that a divine law, no, that let me change that. The Jewish view is it focuses on the origin, not the rationality. Okay? So this is really important because in the Greek culture, in the Hellenistic culture, the only true ethics is a rational ethics. That is, it has to make sense. Okay? In a Jewish culture, the true ethics is of divine origin and it doesn't have to make sense. Right? And there are plenty of examples of this. If you read the Torah, there are some things in there that you scratch your head and say, well, why did God require that? It doesn't make any sense. But it doesn't matter because the emphasis is on the origin of the law, not its rationality, not its functionality. Okay? So when Paul says we know that law is spiritual, he's addressing the origin, not the rationality of it. He's not saying, you as rational ethical beings can go through and examine all of the spiritual principles and you'll find out the ones that are really true make perfect sense. He's not saying that. What he's saying is we know that the commandments come from God. And how do you know that? By tradition, by acceptance of the culture, right? He doesn't offer a proof for that. Okay? And he wouldn't need to offer a proof, because to offer a proof would move that argument into the same rational argument that the Hellenists employ. Okay? But now, if that's true, then we look at the other half of the verse. Okay? Because he says, for we know the law is spiritual, that is, we know the law is divine origin, but I am of flesh, sold into bondage to sin. Okay. Now it looks like, if he's a Platonist, he's saying, oh, poor, woe is me, I'm a prisoner in a corruptible body, and I just need a spiritual escape route, okay? But that's reading the text as though it were Hellenistic. Now I want to point out a couple of things about this text, right? And the first one is that the word for I am fleshly, it shouldn't be translated I am of flesh, right? It should be translated I am fleshly. We just don't have a word like that in English, so they use the possessive of flesh, right? But Paul doesn't look at it that way. He doesn't look at it as though the body is corruptible and I'm imprisoned. What he's saying is, I live in an embodied mortal state, okay? And how do I know that? Because if I look at the Septuagint, I find that this Greek word, sarx, is not connected with sensuality, right? And in fact, it's never used for the flesh of a sacrifice. It distinguishes the spheres between spiritual and not physical, but spiritual and human, right? And although it's not the same as a cosmic dualism, it does notice the difference between creator and creature. Okay, so, but what's interesting is I'm going to read you this paragraph about what happens in the non-canonical text. The texts that were circulating in the first century prior to the canonization of the Hebrew scriptures. Okay? And here's what it says. Common features are the use of sarx for animals, humans, or both, the reference to the flesh of circumcision, the description of woman as the very flesh of man, and the use of sarx for the corruptible body, right? New points of use are flesh and blood for human beings and the expression sama sarkos, which is from Syriac. The bacillus sarconus is contrasted with the bacillus ton theon, the kingdom of God, the kingdom of flesh. Okay. The contrast between Sarx and Pneuma continues. Under Hellenist influence, there is a tendency to equate Sarx with sinful sexuality and passion. So this is really interesting, because if you go read the apocryphal works like Enoch, like the Testament of the Twelve, like the Assumption of Moses, if you start reading Baruch, if you read Syriac, if you read Ecclesiasticus, you're going to see the influence of Hellenism with this word, right? You will see that where the Septuagint does not treat Sarx as a word that describes the sensuality of corporeal living, the non-canonical works start moving in the direction of Hellenism. So by the end of the second century BCE, the concept of a dualism is already embedded in Jewish apocryphal thinking. Okay? So that's really important, because what it says is if Paul is orthodox and thinking in terms of Basar, which is the Hebrew equivalent of Sarx most of the time, we'll talk about that in a second, then he's not thinking in terms of a corruptible human flesh that's tempted by various lusts. He's thinking of the whole process of embodiment and not distinguishing a cosmic dualism between spiritual and physical. But by the time you get to the second century, that concept in Hellenism has already invaded Jewish thinking, and it starts showing up in first and second century work. Okay? So what we're looking at in Romans is right on the edge of this slide into Hellenism, which is why Augustine and others picked up on this verse and read it as though Paul were a Hellenist. Okay? Now, one more thing. Okay. So this is about the verb sold, and the NASB has sold into, but the word is really hupo. It's sold under. And there's an important difference here. Okay? So first we'll talk about the verb. In the secular Greek, the verb literally means to sell, or to sell for a bribe, or to lease, or figuratively to betray, to be led astray, to be ruined. The New Testament uses the same verb literally for to sell in Matthew and Acts, and figuratively appears in Romans 7:14 to describe the desperate plight of a person sold under sin. So what does that mean, to be sold under sin? Well, if you think about the idea of sell for a bribe or lease, it doesn't mean that there's a dominating power within you which controls you because you are sold into it. It means that there is a choice. There's always a choice present that presents you with the opportunity to do something that you ordinarily wouldn't do, or to choose something that you know is in opposition to God's will, simply because there's a human component to this, right? It's as though being alive in the world presents you with all kinds of opportunities, and you constantly have to make choices about it, okay? If I read sold into sin, that carries the nuance of I can't do anything about it. I'm finished, right? If I read sold under sin, that means that there's a principle in action here that allows always the choice to be made, and the choice could send me in either direction. And for that, I want to look at how Uriel ben Mordecai translates the same verse. Okay? So we'll switch over to his text here, and he says, I probably have to read 15 too. Ah, but now, oh, sorry, 14. But, one more page back. Ah, here we go. We are genuinely aware that the Torah is divinely inspired. Okay, so the law is spiritual, right? Spiritual, divine inspiration, which means it comes from God. However, and this is interesting, I am human. He's not saying I am flesh. I am human, because remember, the Septuagint doesn't treat flesh as though it's a concatenation of lusts. It treats flesh as embodiment. Okay. However, I am human, he says, being refined under sway of the choice to sin. Okay? So I think he's really captured this much better, because what he's saying is, because I'm human, I will always be at the crossroads of choice. And the crossroads of choice always gives me the opportunity to do something other than what I would choose to do, whether what God would choose for me to do. Okay? Why is this important? Because we're going to find out something about the idea of a house that comes up in a few verses down. But I want you to notice that flesh, this word sarx, in Hebrew, basar, is translated 145 times with sarx, but 23 times by soma, 79 times by kreos, and a whole bunch of other various Greek terms, which means that in the Septuagint, it wasn't necessarily a function of lustful imprisonment. In the Septuagint, it's viewed as one of the many options for what we would call human embodiment, right? The very fact that you are an embodied being, a person, right? By the way, if I read this as a Hellenist verse, that means that I also can endorse the separation of spirit and body, so that the spirit goes to heaven, the body goes to the earth. Because I'm completely spiritual in heaven, there's no sin. That implies, by the way, that there's no choice, which is really an interesting kind of situation to think about. What would heaven be like if you didn't have any choice? Okay, got all those complications. But nevertheless, that's the Hellenist direction will allow me to say, okay, you see that sarx is always about lustful corruption. And that's just not true in the Septuagint, and it's certainly not true in Paul's thinking, okay? So, if we read as Urim and Mordecai reads, but I am human, then we recognize, okay, the law comes from God. The law is of divine origin, and I'm human. And what does that mean? I have to choose to enact a law that doesn't come from my own humanity. That would be a Greek view, right? It's not a law that I generated from myself through rational ethics. It's a law that comes from outside of me. It's divinely inspired. That means I have to make a choice. And each time I make the choice, the opportunity is always there to not make that choice, right? So when he says, but I am human, right? But I'm human, I'm in... Urim and Mordecai says, swayed under the influence of, and he might as well have said, I am human because I have to make a choice each time, because I have to decide each time, right? It's not a matter of me simply operating on rational principles, and it's not a matter of me, being compelled to do something. Each time I'm going to have to make a choice, okay? So now we have the background from Paul's perspective and the Hellenist perspective, and let's see how those two are developed. Okay? So he says in 15, for that which I am doing, I do not understand, for I'm not practicing what I would like to do, but I am doing the very thing I hate. Okay? So that looks like, if we read 14, that there's a sinful nature in me, it looks like an alien force has captured me and making me do the things that I really don't want to do. But what if Paul is simply describing the human situation? That in those cases where I choose to do other than what God wants, it inevitably involves me in looking back on it and saying, oh my gosh, how could I have been so stupid? How could I have been so wrong? What made me do that? And of course, it was me that made me do it because I made the choice, but it looks as though in hindsight, this was completely alien thing. I don't recognize myself doing that, even though I know that I'm the one who made the choice. Okay? So, Urim ben Mordecai translates this verse as, page, honestly, that which I am deciding about, I am not privy to, where in truth I want to do this thing, but I also hate doing that thing. In other words, what he's saying is there's this strain of choice. I'm always conflicted, right? Think about this. It might be that you automatically choose to do the things that God wants you to do now. But there was a time when you had to make that a habit, because it doesn't come about simply by nature. You are involved in decision conflict at every point. And of course, the biblical instructions in the Mosaic Code are the guidelines to give you some hint as to what the proper choices should be. But that doesn't mean that any of them become automatic. It means that each time I'm confronted, I have a conflict to resolve. And so Paul's saying, if I look at it afterwards and I've been disobedient, I just don't understand why I would have done that thing. Right? As Berkauer says, sin is insanity, because doing what God wants is not only the actual human thing to do, but as Paul's pointed out, gives all kinds of benefits because God prizes obedience, right? But after I've been disobedient, I look back and say to myself, man, I don't even recognize why I did that, right? And I think that's what Paul's describing. He's not describing the case of being compelled to do something. He's describing the case of regretful reflection and not understanding how I could have made those choices along the way. Okay, so then in 16 he says, but if I do the very thing which I do not wish to do, I agree with the law, confessing that's good. And of course, I'll give you Uriel's translation. Pretty much this says the same thing. But if, when I desire to carry out this thing, then I agree with Torah owing to the fact that it is beneficial. So what Paul's saying is, if I really do something that is not a benefit to me, and then I later, upon reflection, realize that it was completely opposite of what I wanted to do, and I don't even see myself in that as that kind of person, then what I'm really doing is acknowledging that Torah is the correct way. I just haven't done it. I see Torah as the solution to a problem that I didn't, is the solution to a problem that I had and chose not to follow. Okay. Now, this is important for two points. The first is that in Paul's letter, he clearly, in this verse, clearly recognizes the importance of Torah as the moral guidebook. Right? Because he says, hey, listen, after I realize what a mess I've created for myself, I look back and see Torah, and I realize that was the solution I didn't take. Okay? So it's never the case that he replaces Torah with irrational ethics. Because even here, after he's sinned, he looks back and says, oh my gosh, that was what I should have done. Okay? So he acknowledges the authority of Torah. That's the first principle. The second principle is this perfectly aligns with verse 14, where he says the law is spiritual. If the law is of, and we know that that means the law comes from God, it's of divine origin. So Torah as divine origin then becomes the standard by which I judge my own choices. Okay? So now let's look at 17. For now, no longer am I doing one thing, but sin which indwells me. Ah, okay, so here we have it again. Looks like a Hellenist verse, right? It looks like, oh my gosh, Paul couldn't help it. There's this thing inside of him that made him sin. And of course, that's the Reformed position. Total depravity, unconditional election. You know, the whole idea is that you can't make any choices that will lead you to God. He has to make the choices because you're completely and totally corrupt. Okay? So let's see what Ben Mordecai does with this verse. It's number 17. So he says, ah, but now it's no longer my successfully doing it, but about the choice to sin sitting beside me. Now, that's important. Okay? Because the word for indwell here is a word in Greek, oikos, that's about households. It's about family, house, race, tribe. It has all kinds of other interesting implications. Let me give you the rest of them. Hold on. Oh, I don't have it here. It's used for lease. It's used for property ownership. It's the whole idea of belonging to a place. Okay. But what's interesting is if I translate it as indwells, it has the nuance, as we're going to see in verse 20, the same word. It has the nuance that there's some permanent resident in my house that's controlling me. Right? So the way that the text is translated under a Reformed theology is that the indwelling of sin becomes the dominant force in my house, the controlling force. But if I read the word oikos in its other versions, it doesn't mean that it's that the owner of the property is sin. It means that the boarder is sin. The person who's, you know, temporarily in residence because I allow it, which is a very different process than, you know, a permanent owner sitting in the castle. Okay? So that's why I think Uriel's translation, where he uses the term sitting beside me, is the best for understanding this idea of indwelling. Because indwelling and sitting beside me have two different nuances. One of them means permanently attached to me. Something has happened to me so that I am no longer free from this. Sitting beside me means the opportunity is there and I have to choose. Right? Sitting beside me doesn't make me do anything. It's when I take that opportunity and adjust my behavior to the one sitting beside me that, you know, that the sin occurs. Okay? In other words, yep. This is James. To be tempted is not to sin. Right? To be tempted is to recognize the opportunity of choice. Okay? And I think what Uriel ben Mordecai is trying to point out when he uses sitting beside me instead of indwell is that always the choice is there. Right next to me is the opportunity for me to act in a different way. Okay? But that doesn't mean that it compels me to do it. Did you have a comment, yep. Michael?
Yeah, is that the same idea where Yah told Abel, you know, sin is crouching at your door and ready to pounce on you?
Ah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. But yes, for chapter 4, I think it's verse 17. Yeah, where God says to Cain, don't you, basically Cain's offering is refused, okay? It doesn't say why, but God says, you know, just go back and fix it and bring it back and it'll be fine. And then he says to Cain, but be very careful because now sin is crouching at the door. And of course, there's a really interesting nuance to that. It's like sin is ready to attack you, but it's not going to happen unless you open the door. Okay? The lion can't get in unless you open the cage. Okay? So what God is saying is you're not at the place where you can't do anything about it. You're at the place where you have to choose if you're going to open the door or not. And by the way, Adam, when Paul described Adam, he used the same kind of language. Remember that Adam opened the door to sin. He allowed that process to begin, which is Genesis chapter 3. So the same thing is here. There's a big difference between indwelling, which means I'm sitting in the cage with the lion, and sitting next to me, which means that the door of the cage is between me and the lion. I can guarantee you that there's a huge difference between those two because I have been on the opposite side of the fence from the lion. And I'm telling you, the lion was 2 feet away and angry, right? If there hadn't been a fence, I would be devoured. So the point is the fence protected me from the lion. And Paul is saying, not that you're sitting in the cage with the lion, but that the fence is there. The fence is Torah. It tells you what to do. If you open the cage, you're only going to regret it later. Right? So, but the cage door is always there. It's always open. It's always ready for you to grasp the handle, open the door, and be devoured. Okay? Of course, that's insanity, but that's the way it works. Okay. So let's see what else he says. So he says.
Escape. Out of yes. Here. I have I have a question. Yes, I fully understand what you're explaining. I've came across that before, so I understand. But I have a question. When Jesus said, if you lust of a woman in your heart, you've already sinned. So how do you understand that verse?
Ah, okay. The first point is to make sure that we understand exactly what he's saying. Because the term that he uses is not a term where you walk the, it's not the term when I go to Venice and I see some woman dressed in an absolutely beautiful, gorgeous costume and I think, oh my gosh, she's so beautiful, right? That's not the term. The term is that I plan a way to create the act even if I don't do it, right? So the idea is I've actually gone through the process of committing the sin. I just haven't behaviorally fulfilled it. So what Yeshua says is, don't you see that the mental process of figuring out how to make it happen is the equivalent of making it happen? Okay? But there's always the opportunity that says, oh, wait a minute. If I thought about this, I could make it happen, but I'm not going to think about it anymore because there's a fence there. There's a cage, right? But the opportunity is there. It's always going to raise itself, and that's what he's addressing. That will always be the opportunity to think how to make it happen. Okay, so can we go back? We'll go back to 18. For I know that nothing good dwells in me. Boy, what a Platonist thing. That is, in my flesh. Isn't that great? Because if I say, for I know nothing good dwells in me, period, then everyone would say, wait a minute, that's not true. I have good feelings. I have good intentions. There are things that are good in me. But look what he says. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is, in my flesh. And, of course, the Platonists jumped all over this. Because what they're saying is, don't you see? Paul recognized that being embodied, that being corporate, being in a fleshly shell is the real cause. It's the reason that all this stuff happens, right? If we could just get rid of the fleshly shell, oh my gosh, the world would be so much better. So what do we have to do? Well, to get rid of the fleshly shell, there are some solutions to this, by the way, to get rid of the fleshly shell. How do we do that? Okay. Well, we can join a convent and deprive ourselves of as many of the lustful temptations that we could imagine. Or we can join a monastery and do the same, okay? Or we could beat ourselves into submission, right? You can walk around with a whip and whip your back every time that you think of a lustful thought, okay? Or there's an even better solution. You could die, right? Because then you won't have to worry about all these bodily temptations. You're finished with it, right? So you could simply, as Justin Martyr said, wish that he would be martyred so that he could be with God and stop having to fight all this stuff, okay? So there are some solutions. Of course, Paul's solution is the metaphorical identification with death that we already looked at, right? We already looked at how he's developed that. This is sort of after that theoretical argument, now he's going to talk about the practical one, right? So his solution still is the same, but it's not a solution that says I'm going to get rid of my bodily temptations by killing off the body, right? What he's saying is, I find that when I reflect on the opportunities that I had that took me away from Torah, they all originated in the fact that I'm human. Right? In other words, he's not saying there's nothing in me that's of value at all. What he's saying is being human presents me with this problem. And it's not like I can avoid it. Right? If there's something about being human bless God, there's something about being human that causes me to constantly be in this conflict. But that's what it means to be human. So if I'm going to get rid of the conflict, I either have to stop being human, or I have to figure out a way to escape this body, right? And the dualist, of course, wants to escape the body, the physical world. By the way, it isn't just Hellenists that believe this, right? Same thing happens in Buddhism, you know, the escape from the physical, right? So that's a universal religious issue when it comes to bodily involvement in the world. So Paul's not being simply an anti-Hellenist here. But what he's saying is, look, you are human. There's no way around that. It's something that is just part of who you are. And in order to be human, in order to understand what it means to be human, you will have to confront this constant possibility of choosing the wrong direction. Right? So he says, hey, when I look back on it, I think to myself, everything that I've struggled with came from the very fact that I'm embodied in the world. Okay? So, for I know that there's nothing good in me doesn't mean that there's not a single good thing that he's ever done. It means that he's in constant conflict. And that's just what it means to be human. So, Uriel ben Mordecai translates this. I really am aware that what is advantageous may not be so immediately apparent. As it happens, this is what I wish was at my disposal. And it's the thing you need to successfully bring about the right thing. It's not, and he continues, in fact, whatever I might feel like doing the right thing, but rather, whatever I might feel like pursuing that disastrous course of action. So the two verses go together, okay? So he says, for I know that there's nothing good that dwells in me, that is in my flesh, and so we're going to read that as, I know I'm human, so I'm constantly going to be in this conflict. And then he says, for wishing is present with me, that's one side of the choice, but doing the good is not. And he doesn't mean that I can't do it. He means that because the opportunity is there, I'm constantly going to be in conflict over what choice I will make. And 18, for the good that I wish, I do not do. Okay? So here's the problem. I think to myself, my gosh, Torah is clear enough on this. I see what is right, but there's that part of me that just, you know, it's like the kid who figures out a way to get an extra cookie. Right? It's part of human nature to figure out a way around it. Okay? And that all that Paul's saying is we have trained ourselves over the course of our entire human lives to figure out a way around it. Okay? And as a result of that, the disastrous thing that results, we recognize afterwards, oh my gosh, if I had just done the right thing to begin with, it would have been fine. Okay? But we don't. So he says, the good thing that I wish, I don't do, but I practice the very evil I don't wish. And of course, what he's saying is, when I reflect on this, I end up realizing that I do the things that I knew were going to cause me disaster, but there's this kind of operating something in my humanity that allows me to keep thinking of ways around this. Okay? Now, this reminds me of the book by Moshe Lozato, right? In his argument is, this is Musar training, right? His argument is that we haven't trained ourselves to see the string of choices that led ultimately to a violation of Torah. Because it doesn't happen just at the point of violating Torah. Nobody starts off the day thinking, today I'm just going to, it's going to be such an opportunity for me to steal things today. Nobody starts like that, right? What happens is, along the way, little things happen that each time I cross over that boundary, which isn't the sin, it prepares me for the next boundary. And so Moshe Luzzatto talks about backing up in your thinking to think, what were the things that I did before I got to this sinful act? And then, what were the things that I did before that that led me to the step before the sinful act? And then, what was the step three steps back that led me to the step that led me to the step that led me to, you know, you see it, right? An infinite regress. And his point is that if I can train myself to get clued into the first part of that chain of events, when I first see the chain of events, that's the point where I can easily decide to go a different direction, because it doesn't have all the pressure behind it. But as I make the steps forward, each time I make the step, the pressure to continue the chain of events gets greater, right? So Musar training, which comes from his book Mesili Yesharim, is all about identifying the line of chain of events so that I can figure out what was it that set me off on that path. Okay? It's like me going to the therapist for 2 years to figure out why I was so resistant to suggestions by my wife. Okay? And of course, it took me 2 years in therapy to realize that I was fighting with my mother, who had died years before, and I never had the opportunity to actually back up and say, what was the thing that caused me to be so angry with her suggestions, when what she was doing, in her mind, of course, she was trying to guide me. But something happened along that way that made me react to the suggestion instead of confronting the person whose origin started all of that, right? So Moshe Luzzatto wants me to back up and say, oh, what was the thing that triggered all of that? Okay, it was because when you heard Roseanne say something, you were actually hearing your mother's voice when you were six telling you something that you couldn't do. And if you just realize that that was happening to a six-year-old and not to a 76-year-old, then you would recognize that you were responding to your mother's voice when you were six and not to your wife's suggestion. You understand what I'm saying? Okay? So I think that's what's happening in this verse. Paul is saying, you know, afterwards I realize, my goodness, by the time I got to the step where I couldn't make the choice anymore because the pressure of continuing down the chain of events was so enormous that it literally carried me there, the problem was that I never identified the steps prior to that, and if I had listened to Torah long enough, I would have started to recognize the steps that came way before that that would have prevented me from getting into the situation where I just felt like I couldn't help it. I could have helped it, because it's always a choice, but the choice to stop at that point is 1,000 times greater in energy than the choice to recognize what the beginning of the whole thing was, you know, some little tiny event that triggered this whole process. Yes.
But to me, I was just going to say, it's like the fences they put around, you know, the commandments, but to stop you from getting to my point, for me, it also causes fearful living too, in some ways, because, you know, you become afraid to do anything almost sometimes, because to keep yourself from getting to, you know, a point like that. So it for me, sometimes it's almost like I'm afraid to do anything, you know?
Well, you can see how it would cause paralysis, because if the only thing that you recognize is the last step before you committed the sin, then you're almost helpless, because the last step is something that you just can't stop, right? By the time you get to that point, the whole neural network is in place to push you along the chain, right? But there's a really good therapeutic exercise to go back, to back up through the chain to realize what it was, what was the trigger event that started all this stuff in the first place, right? I think I've told you that there's a book by Mark Wolin called It Didn't Start With You. And I think it's a really, really important book because what he shows, he's a psychologist, not a theologian. But what he shows is that the chain of events that usually starts with the kind of behaviors that cause you disaster didn't even actually start with you. They started way before you, in maybe one or two generations before you. And, you know, I'll give you a little bit of therapy background. One of the reasons that I was so angry with my mother is because I always felt like she favored my brother more than me. And he was always the one who was idolized and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I felt like I worked my butt off to accomplish the things that I thought were important, and they weren't recognized as important, but I never felt special. Okay. So I had to back up in therapy to figure out where did that feeling come from. And ultimately I realized that my closest brother is 13 months younger than me. So when I was 13 months old, there was an infant in the house, which meant, of course, that I wasn't given the same amount of attention as a 13-month-old because the infant was more important. And then I realized that when I was born, I was separated from my mother because there was a problem with me with the birth, and I was basically in an ICU unit, right? So I didn't even have the nurturing and bodily contact that's necessary for a newborn to feel like you're connected. That mother went through the same kind of, and then I realized my kind of thing, right? So it wasn't her fault that she was, you know, that I felt abandoned. It was she was trying to deal with her own emotional issues, and they cascaded into me. They cascaded into me in vitro, they cascaded into me in the ICU, they cascaded into me when my brother was born at 13 months after me, and all of my life, that cascade of events caused me to feel abandoned, right? So when I get a suggestion, which from an important woman in my life, that sounds like a criticism, it causes all of that, all those trigger emotions to surface, and I respond with resistance and anger instead of realizing that the suggestion was intended to benefit me, right? And by the way, the same thing happens with God, right? If I feel like all that the Torah is doing is condemning me for all the things that I don't do right, I will have the same kind of abandonment rejection issues going on that were caused by some long history of emotional issues in my own life and have nothing to do with Moses. But I can hear Moses sounding exactly like my mother when I read commandments that cause me to feel condemned. Right? Do you understand what I'm saying now? Okay. And what's interesting is all human beings have this kind of history, right? We all have, as Paul says, we all have this being human in the world. And it's not simply a matter of the choice that I make now. It's a matter of living with all the baggage that I was handed from choices that I never made, but ended up changing my life. Right? And working my way out of them is a lifetime process. Yeah, Phyllis, you had something to add?
No, I was just going to say, that I understand all that. I'm just saying in some ways, when you back in regards to Torah commandments and things like that, or just choices you make, a lot of times you can paralyze yourself because you're trying to keep from doing anything that gets you closer to something you are tempted by, or something that, you know, you can't have anything to do with, or whatever choice, you know, that you can also become paralyzed to do absolutely nothing, you know, to keep from getting back close to the cliff. You know, it can affect you that way, you know, mentally. Yes.
Yeah, but I think that the important thing there is to recognize what we often miss in the Genesis account, and I tried to make that clear in my book Crossing, that the The real message of Genesis from Abraham to Joseph is the care of the father, right? The real message behind all those stories, behind Abraham, Isaac, Joseph, Jacob, the whole thing, all of those people, right? The real message there is who cares for these people as father? Because every single one of the fathers in that lineage failed. Every single one. Right? So what's interesting is if my experience of my father is one of distance, I will feel the same kind of thing when it comes to God. I have to change my thinking about who God is as father in order to realize that the Mosaic Code is not there to set rules and condemn me. The Mosaic Code is there to be the most important instruction book that I can have from a father who loves me and who cares intimately about everything that happens. And I find so difficult to recognize God like that because I have a history, because I have, you know, lots and lots of emotional issues that I inherited that came from, you know, people that I made no choices about whatsoever, but they influence my ability to, as Paul would say, my ability to recognize when the trigger events occur that send me down these paths. Okay? They influence that. They change it.
I guess sometimes you have to realize that sometimes you'll make the wrong choice. But you just have to.
Well, that's interesting because now we're going to see a verse that actually suggests something like that. Okay? So let's go to the next one.
Just before you move on, a comment and a question. Comment. Gabor Mate said when he talks about addiction, he found out that it's not the taking of the heroin that was the big thing. It's the process of getting to the heroin, the whole experience of getting there. So when people realize that the high is really the experience, because the high is only 5 minutes of heroin, right? But the whole getting it and getting the contacts and the right timing and how am I going to go about it makes me think of your thing about lust, right? It's that whole thing that's in the mind. That's the adrenaline that he realized that the addicts, you know, had to break more than just the taking of the heroin.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, that's why Paul can say, at the end, when I actually see what I've done, I don't even recognize myself. It's like, wait a minute, why did I even do that? Because it wasn't the action itself. It was all of the chain of events that led to it. It was the ritual it was the ritual that created the drive to get to the end. But the end is never fulfillment, right? The end is always the sort of letdown because everything else in the process was the emotional motivator that moved me in that direction, right? Yeah, so that's
the question I have. What about Yetzer Hara and Atov? That came later than Paul, right? In Judaism, is that their conflict?
Yetzer Hatov is the rabbinic idea that was circulating at the time. So
at
Paul would
have
been aware of that.
Okay, so is that what he's sort of using?
I think what he's saying is, here's what I think Paul's saying. You're human. Every human being is going to be faced with this conflict of choice. You can't help but have the conflict because that's what it means to be human. So don't think you're going to escape the conflict by somehow becoming spiritual. That's what it means to be human. And isn't it wonderful that God created you with the possibility of dealing with the conflict because when you make choices, it pleases God, and when you don't make the choices, then you discover that you should have, right? So there's a learning process that goes on here, right? He's not saying you have a fatal flaw that prevents you ever from doing the right thing, and the only choice that you have is conversion and the new man so that you become someone else. That's not what Paul's saying, right? What he's saying is you're alive in the world. Isn't it amazing? And isn't it awful? It's awful, amazing at the same time, because you're going to have to struggle with this stuff. You're going to feel paralyzed. You're going to feel depressed. You're going to feel regret. But That's what it means to be human. So let's go see how this all works out. Because he's aiming at getting to the solution in chapter 8. Okay? He's painting the picture as drastically as he can, because what he's saying is, once you get the heroin, you thought it was going to solve everything, but it just makes it more, more important to try it again, to get more. Okay.
Okay, good.
All right. Okay, I want to proceed to 20, right? But if I am doing the very thing I do not wish, I am no longer the one doing it, but sin which dwells in me. And so here's the same word again, oikos, from indwells, and now the NASB translates it as dwells in me. Okay? So remember what I said. It's about house, family, lease, ownership. It's about ethnicity. It's about race. It's a wide umbrella of meanings for this word. And of course, Uriel ben Mordecai translates it as sitting beside me, which I think is really an important translation, because it removes the idea that you can't help it, that it's causing this. Okay? All he's really, because if I say that sin dwells in me, it's like, wait a minute, that's a permanent part of me. I can't get rid of it. Right? But that's not what he's saying. What he's saying is that the opportunity is always there. There's always the choice to be made. Okay? Okay, so he says, so Uriel ben Mordecai translates this. And at this point, if in this I were to do whatever I might want, in other words, if I were to choose to do whatever I want to, then it's no longer me successfully causing it to come to pass, but the choice to sin sitting beside me. In other words, what happens when I choose is I realize, oh my gosh, I didn't even want to do that afterwards. I think, oh my gosh, that was really stupid. But in the process, I've already committed the sin. So it's the emotional motivator, I get on the rails and it takes me to that point. Okay. So he says, I find then the principle that evil is present in me. Okay. Now we should be really careful here, because this is an interesting translation, right? Because remember when we talked about the fact that the translator makes a decision about how he's going to deal with the word nomos, right? And whenever we come across the word nomos in a Christian context that requires the rejection of the Torah, it will be translated as Torah, okay? But here, the same word is translated as principle, right? Which is not, I mean, you could have said the law of evil, but then you would have flatly contradicted Paul's, but is the law evil? Of course not, he says, right? So here, the translator uses the word principle, which means that we could have translated the same word nomos as principle many other times before, right? Like scientific principles, like scientific laws. We don't mean the Mosaic code, okay? But this is important, where he says, but I find then that the principle that evil is present in me, the one who wishes to do the good, okay? And Uriel translates this, then I discover the Torah, which is bidding me to do the right thing in light of the fact that for me, the detrimental thing is at hand, okay? So I got why he would translate it as Torah, but it's unnecessary for Paul to say that the only thing that I find in me, Uriel translates it the opposite of what Paul's saying here. Paul's saying is, I discover that in me there's this, you know, there's this contrary chain of events that's motivated by my desire to have what I want and do what I want. Okay? But Uriel ben Mordecai says, but I discover that the Torah, which is bidding me to do good, is not something that I'm embracing at this moment. And what I'm saying is, I don't need to use the word Torah at all in this translation. All I have to really have is the idea that there's some other opposing sequence. And I think we've talked about that enough so that you recognize that Paul doesn't have to talk about Torah in order to show an audience that they struggle with the conflict of right moral action. He doesn't even have to have Torah. Torah helps because it embodies a divine perspective on what is expected, but I don't need Torah in order to know that I make mistakes, in order to know that I've failed. All I need is any societal expectation that I failed to meet, and that will be enough to force me to start to recognize that I sometimes choose to do those things that I later realize weren't even what I wanted. Okay? So, 21. Oh, that is 21. 22. For I joyfully concur with the law of God, so now it is Torah, in the inner man. And unfortunately, now we've got another translation that looks like we're talking about a Platonic dualism. Okay, so let's see what Ben Mordecai translates. The truth is, I celebrate God's Torah in terms of the one thing deep down inside of me. And that's probably a better translation than the inner man, because the inner man makes it look like there's a spiritual man in me surrounded by a physical outer man, the shell that keeps me a prisoner of lust, right? What Ben Mordecai is pointing out is that there is something deep down inside of me, the one person, that has to struggle with this conflict, right? It's not possible for me to simply become somebody else. It's possible only that I deal with the internal conflict that I've inherited and that I've chosen, and figure out a way to allow the benevolence of God's Torah to guide me, which, by the way, isn't always so easy to do. Okay, so he says, for I see a different law in the members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind. Oh my gosh, the Platonists go crazy, right? Because now what they're saying is, don't you see what Paul is saying is, your body is opposed to your mind. There's a cognitive you, and there's a physical you. And the real you is the thinking you. And the problem is the body you, right? The physical you. So we have the typical tripartite body, mind, and soul, right? The body is the terrible part. The mind is the thing that you need to have to control the body, and your soul is what you're trying to rescue from the conflict between mind and body. Okay? Paul's not saying that. Remember, Paul doesn't have a word in Greek for nephesh or neshma, a singular word in Hebrew that encompasses voluntary, cognitive, emotive, all the functions of being human. Paul doesn't have a word like that in Greek. So he has to separate it out with nous, soma, psuche. He's got all those words in Greek that unfortunately have all kinds of other nuances because he doesn't have any combination word. Okay. But if we're going to think like Paul in Hebrew, then we have to see that he's not saying that there's a difference between what's happening in my cognitive being and what's happening in my physical being, so that I become a prisoner of my physical being. He's not saying that, because nephesh is all of it. Nephesh is the embodied me. What he's saying is, I recognize conflict, and it happens to me, the full me. Okay, so let's see what Uriel ben Mordecai says for 23. Okay. However, I am observing another principle within the fabric of my character, right? Nephesh, that wars against the manner of my thinking and seizes me by way of the principle of choice to rebel. So what he's saying is, I think, pretty close to what we read in the Genesis 3 account. Okay? Here's what we have to recognize. In the Genesis 3 account, the woman does not make a deliberate choice to sin. She chooses based on what her belief is about the commandment. the commandment was given to her inaccurately. So she responds to the lack of evidence to show that the commandment was that the commandment could be violated in the way that she thought the commandment was given. Adam is the one who knows what the commandment actually says, and he remains silent in the encounter with the serpent, causing all of this damage, okay? Which is basically says this. In the case of the woman, even though she technically violates the commandment, she doesn't do it with malice aforethought. She doesn't do it intentionally. The result is still the collapse of the relationship with both her husband, with Adam and with God. But it doesn't happen because she deliberately decided to make it happen. It happens because she was exactly in this position. She was given evidence that her physical desires were not prohibited by the command because it didn't say anything about the physical desires. And so when the serpent presents that option and then demonstrates that it's not true, she makes an assumption about the rest of the command and as a result makes a mistake. She makes a mistake because she didn't have all the proper information. And Paul could basically say the same thing. What happens to you? You have Torah as a guidebook. You recognize that Torah is from God and it's divinely inspired. But you live in the human environment where you're constantly surrounded by choice. And some of those choices are brought about in your life, not because you made the decision, but because it got passed down to you in the generations that came before you that spin humanity in a way so that things that essentially might be questionable later turn out to be mistakes, but you didn't know that at the time, or you thought there was a way around it at the time. So it isn't like you're sitting down and saying, I'm going to fight this out, war, right? He says, warring with me. You only see that in reflection, because afterwards you recognize that what was really happening is you're responding to all these other triggers that happened in your life that caused you to go down this path that ultimately led to disaster, but you didn't recognize that it was happening at the time because you weren't apprised of what was really occurring, and you were only thinking in terms of the final result. Okay? So what he's basically saying is that's the situation that we're all in, right? And that's why he can say, wretched man that I am, who will set me free from the body of this death? And what he means, not that you have to escape the physical world, but he's saying, look, I'm constantly in conflict and I make a lot of mistakes. And I realize that I make the mistakes only afterwards. And then I feel horrible about it. And now what am I going to do to ever fix this? Because I can't get behind the chain fast enough to prevent all this stuff from occurring. It just sweeps me along, right? And when I get caught in it, it's really almost impossible for me to get out of the last few steps because I've already been on this path all the way down to this point, and now I can't escape. Okay? So he says, what's the solution? How am I going to get out of that? How am I ever going to change that? Okay? Because his solution is going to come. It's just that he wants to make it as, what's the right word? He wants to make it as drastic as possible so that people will identify with the ultimate result of this process and will recognize not that this happens to you every single time, but that when you recognize that it happened, it condemns you enough so that you feel like, how am I ever going to fix this? Because that's where he wants his audience to be. He wants his audience to be at the point where they're desperate for a solution. In other words, to put it in terms of addictive behavior, Paul wants his audience to get to the bottom of the well. He wants them to be at the point where they can't possibly live one more day without a solution. Because then the solution will make a big difference. Otherwise, it'll just be medication instead of transformation. Okay? Are we good so far? Because the next verse really belongs to the next chapter, right? This is the end of the piece that where he's setting up the stage for his solution. So the next verse really should be in chapter 8. I don't know why they break it there. So let's see what Urdo ben Mordecai says for this verse 24. I'm a pathetic human being. Okay? Look how different that is. Wretched man that I am. I'm a pathetic human being. Right? Pathetic. That means, and by the way, wretched means something different than pathetic. Pathetic means I'm helpless. I just can't find my way out of this. Wretched means I'm evil. I'm condemned, right? I'm a pathetic human being. Who can release me out of this? And now he has physical reality of this process of death, but I wouldn't say it like that because it's not the physical reality that I'm working against. It's the very fact of human embodiment. It's not just physical. It's my emotional well-being. It's my cognitive, you know, understanding. It's my volitional choices. It's all of that, right? It isn't me trying to get rid of my physical desires. It's me dealing with all of this stuff, right? And of course, most of the time what I discover is that the physical desire comes long after the emotional abandonment. I just substitute one for the other. And perhaps Paul's got that same kind of thinking, that it isn't simply, I just need to get rid of all these bodily lusts. It's, no, I need to go through the process of understanding what makes me human. Okay? So now we're going to transition to the next chapter, but we're going to pick up the next chapter with the last verse of chapter 7. Okay? Any questions? Any comments? Because now there's a big shift coming.
Yeah, Skip.
Oh, hold it. Dan, go ahead.
Now, I was thinking the thought of this is you've written several times that you know, you've gone back and read something you've written and said, I need to rewrite that. And I wonder if how Paul would interpret this if he had to go back and rewrite it. And it kind of, would he use different words or is the words relevant for the time and today's word? You know, it's all that stuff rolling around in my brain.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, that's a good point because I think given the impact of Hellenism in the Western world, if Paul were writing this today, he would use much more psychological terms than he would use these Greek highly influenced terms like soma, nous, soma body, nous mind, psuche spirit. I don't think he'd use any of those because today he would be talking in terms of psychological, you know, the whole person kinds of ideas. Benita, you had something you wanted to add?
Yeah, you know, you triggered something when you said about Paul and his whole, first, the emotional comes. You know, I'm just thinking of the Lisa's statement on the cocaine addict there that, you know, the whole process of getting to attain. And so for Paul, the sin, the whole process first, I believe it starts with his emotion and then it's linked to his own past and et cetera, et cetera. But it's at the present, it's his emotion that triggers off or our emotions that starts the process of either swaying away from the law that keeps us. And I think it's very important to look at that one part too, the emotion of it all that causes us to step over the boundary because it's linked to something in our past that triggers us to, you know, just walk over that boundary safeguard of the law and just, well, you know, my emotion is stronger than, and it, you just go on and you sin. So,
yeah.
So the word emotion is
sure. That's an important point. And the point that you're making doesn't show up if I divide the human being into body, mind, and soul, right? Because that doesn't allow room for the homogenization of emotional involvement. Paul Tournier is a really famous Swiss psychotherapist, basically said that human beings ride on the rails of emotion, that's mm-hmm. what really causes us to make choices. It's the emotional stuff. And in fact, there's a really great, I'm trying to remember who the author of the statement is, but basically I can find it, but it basically says, without emotion, there is no learning. So the point is that we are designed, this is a really important Hebrew point. We're designed as emotionally equipped beings. We're not designed as, we're not AI. We're not robots.
Yeah.
In fact, the whole point of the exercise, as I said, you look through the lineage of Abraham to Joseph, the whole point of everything that's happening to those people is emotional conditions, right? Mm-hmm. It's the emotions that drive forward the behavior. And so if we read the scripture from an emotional point of view, I think we'd be much closer to the meaning of the original text than simply treating it as historical narrative or theological, statements or something. Because what really has to happen is we need to feel what's happening to these people so that we can identify how they are responding in their feelings to the situations that they're in and the God who shows up in those situations. And Paul is, I think, doing the same thing. It's a tragedy that we read these verses and we compartmentalize them as a result of our Western tradition, believing that members of the body can only mean hands, feet, eyes, ears, that the sin that dwells in me can only mean that I'm in a, prison house of corporeal reality. We've altered all of the thinking to fit our paradigm of the Western world from, Greek philosophy, instead of recognizing that Paul is grasping at Greek words to try to reach into an audience that isn't familiar with the Hebrew concept of homogeneity in persons, right? Mm-hmm. It would be much better if Paul were writing about persons than about body, mind, and soul.
Yeah.
Right? And then we would start to realize that what he's really trying to talk about is this, is the human nature built into the opportunity for choice, which makes us who we are and creates all the problems that we ultimately face. But it didn't come because of some cognitive issue. It came about because of some emotional issue. That's what's driving the whole thing. And I'm pretty sure, as Dan suggested, Paul would have rewritten this in a very different way had he written it for, 21st century.
Huh.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the emotional thing, if we could learn how to discern rapidly the emotion faced before having to or sinning to go and walk, make causes us to walk into sin or causes us no choice, but a triggered emotion that's either not healed is definitely, if we could put our finger on it before it, we either act on it, discern it. I mean, boy, I think we'd probably learn to be a different person or keep it in line.
Yeah. But I think one of the consequences of being in a Western civilization is something that I've noticed over many years. And that is that we have a very difficult time even identifying the emotion. In other words, I'm sure in the past you must have seen that I provided on Today's Word the feelings wheel, which shows you all, how all of these peripheral feelings are really associated ultimately with six or seven basic emotions like anger, shame, joy, peace, that kind of stuff, right? And the feelings wheel, which you can get online if you want, really helps you start to identify all these, sort of, we think of peripheral things, but they're really all related deeply to these basic emotional triggers that cause us to behave in ways that we look back on and say, well, why was I like that? And again, I think that one of the processes that has to happen in our spiritual education is to become aware of the emotional things that happen in our life. I wrote once about my 70th birthday. My 70th birthday, I spent by myself on an airplane at 35,000 feet flying someplace. I don't even remember where now. And I remember that it took me about 2 weeks to realize how lonely I was, how much I wanted to have the presence of family around me for that event. And, you know, I made commitments to speak someplace and I had to travel. And of course, in those days, I was just doing what I had to do next and not aware of the actual feelings that were happening. But 2 weeks later, I realized how lonely I had been and how disappointed I was that I made choices to fly on that day and how it really hurt me. Right. But my emotional vocabulary is so completely bent out of shape that I didn't even know what was happening at the time until I discovered how I was feeling about it 2 weeks later. Right? So I think that's kind of what Paul's after here. He's trying to paint this picture so that we really come into touch with how desperate we are to find solutions for these chains of events that ultimately lead us to make bad choices, because they don't start with the bad choice. They start with all the stuff before that, right? They start with the sin sitting beside me, not making me do anything, just being there, just the constant presence of knowing, oh, well, I can escape if I want to, right?
So it's okay. Best to surrender to the loving care of God and trust and believe.
And all those words sound good, but sometimes they're really, really hard. Not only do I not understand what they mean, hard to do.
Yes, sir.
You know, you're embroiled in this human condition. You can't escape it. So
yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's just introduce this last verse, and then we'll start with chapter 8 next week. But we got to get to the first verse of chapter 8, which is 7:25. Right. So here's his solution. And it might actually sound a little strange now. We'll see. Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then, on the one hand, I myself with my mind am serving the law of God, but on the other with my flesh, the law of sin. What? How can that be a solution? Right? I mean, thanks be to God that I'm cognitively okay, but my physical life is a mess. Isn't that wonderful? Thank God for that. Okay. No, Uriel ben Mordecai translates this. Well, Baruch Hashem, on account of Yeshua the Mashiach of our Lord. Accordingly, then, with my mental faculty, I myself am serving a principle of God and the reality of a principle to choose sin, which is different than I thank God with my mind, right? What he's saying is, hey, isn't it wonderful that at least I have a cognitive ability to understand why this problem is occurring? Thanks to God, I have the mental capacity to see the situation that I'm in. Okay? And, by the way, in seeing that situation, I say, oh, yes, if I just serve the law of God, if I just follow Torah, I could find my way out of this. Of course, how I'm going to do that is a big issue. But at least I recognize that that's the solution. But on the other, my flesh, the law of sin? No. But on the other, what I recognize is that sin sits beside me every time there's a choice. I don't serve the law of sin. I'm acquainted with an option to choose. And each time it's the me sitting beside me saying, yeah, but you really, you know, let's just get away from all of this. You don't really have to do that now, right? You know that it'll be okay later, right? You have that other option, me, telling me, just open the gate and let's, you know, pretend that everything is okay, okay? So Paul's saying, isn't it wonderful that God at least gave me the mental capacity to understand that there is a way out? That way out is, of course, the instructions that he gives. And he gave me at the same time the mental capacity to realize that there's a conflict inside of me. Now that gets me to chapter 8, because now in chapter 8, he's going to say, okay, because my next question is, okay, great, I got it. Torah is the way, but how? How does that happen? Right? And that'll take us to chapter 8. And by the way, by the time we get to chapter 8, we're pretty much through with all of the really difficult, hard to figure out, confusing stuff about Paul, because now he starts to be really, really clear, and he's driving now toward a solution, right? And then ultimately he's going to talk about what are the implications for this solution on the situation that you're in the assembly with Jews and converts and proselytes and, you know, et cetera. Okay. Okay. So you see where we are? You see how far we've come? You see what Paul's doing here at the end? Basically thanking God that he's got the ability to think his way about this, right? Other comments, questions? Otherwise, you'll have to wait till next week.
Quick question, Skip.
Yeah, Dennis.
With all this stuff we're learning about the Hebrew understanding that we're a whole being, not the spirit and body, what of things like out-of-body experiences or near-death?
Okay, well, two points, just really two really quick points. The first is near death. Near death isn't death. It's near death, which means you're still embodied, right? If you're dead, you don't have a near-death experience, okay? So fortunately, a near-death experience is still a human embodied experience. And by the way, so is an out-of-body experience. You don't actually have another you out of your body. You have the experience of what you think it might be like if you observed yourself from a neutral position. But of course, what happens, you're you, right? No one has an experience where they're not themselves. No out-of-body selves. Understand what I'm saying? An out-of-body experience only happens because you are an embodied person, right? And near-death experience only happens because you aren't dead, right? So we have vocabulary about that, but the truth of the matter is none of those experiences occur without you being human, embodied, right?
Okay.
Yeah, by the way, this throws a big monkey wrench into the notion of soul. I'm going to write some more about that, but you can just read Jacques Ellul's footnote in Against Christianity. Is that the name of it? Something like that. I don't know. There's a big footnote about how Pythagoras is the one to introduce that, and it was adopted into the Christian church, and that's where we get the idea of the eternal existence of the soul. It doesn't come from the Bible at all. Okay? Somebody else had a comment before we leave. Robin.
I wanted to ask a quick question. I hope it's a quick question. What about the issue of those who teach generational curses in the light of this business of stuff being handed down from, you know, one generation to the next?
Okay. So, yes, this is a quick question. Does the Bible teach generational curse? No. That's the answer. Okay. Why do people talk about generational curses? Because there are consequences of what happens from one generation to the next. But that's not the same as a curse. A curse is God directing punishment against a particular person or tribe or nation or entity because of something that they did to violate his commandment or his intention, right? But that's not generational. All the prophets absolutely say no son is ever penalized for his father. Everyone dies for their own sins. Okay, so the prophets are really clear about that. We call it generational curses because we see the consequences of one generation falling on another. But that's generational consequence, not generational curse. Right? So the fact that my father's father died when he was 12 and he experienced no childhood except the childhood of massive responsibility as the oldest of 12 children, right? and running the farm at age 12 and never having a father figure in his life means that I grew up with a father who was distant. So there are consequences, but it's not a curse. It's just what happens in human life.
Yeah, no, I understand. I mean, it's just a thought went through my head.
Yeah, but, no. The backside of that is I can't pray for the forgiveness of a generational curse for my father, whose sin was to be abandoned by his father, and somehow that's going to heal me. No, that it doesn't work like that. And I didn't get cancer because of some sin that was unforgiven my grandfather, right? I mean, the whole John chapter 9 deals with that straight out when the disciples say, you know, whose fault was it this man was born blind? And Yeshua basically says, what's the matter with you? You can't think straight? It has nothing to do with that, right?
Okay. What about Noah then cursing his grandson
after the very different story? Okay. And that will take a long answer.
Okay.
I think I might have written about that, as a matter of fact. So you can check on the verse and see if there's something about today's word.
Okay. Thank you.
Interesting that he curses the grandson, and there's a reason for that. Not the son, by the way, the grandson. Okay.
Yeah.
Anybody else before we call it quits for this week? No. All right. I will see you next regular time next Saturday, and we'll continue with chapter 8.